comes this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 181, 2017's The Evil Within. Now, if you're not familiar with this film, it was released to very little fanfare, despite it having genre icon Michael Berryman in it. It came and went via Amazon streaming.
No theatrical, very, very little in the way of pre-release hype.
Yeah, very little in the way of subsequent reviews. Mm-hmm. We're going to remedy that here because we think this has been overlooked unfairly.
This is sort of like a eccentrically brilliant masterpiece, in my opinion. A flawed masterpiece. And in many ways, the press that the film did get, the pre-release press, was not so much about the movie per se, but about the story behind the movie. How this film first came to my attention was an article in The Guardian. And The Guardian,
our number one source for all things horror.
All things horror, exactly. And it was an article that was entitled, A Millionaire, His Meth Addiction, and the Horror Movie 15 Years in the Making.
Yeah, and you know when a publication that's allegedly highbrow like that descends to the world of horror, you know that it has nothing to do with horror, but the production process. So it had to have something that transcended horror because they're famously antipathic toward horror. So yes, the backstory.
Yeah, well, so first of all, it's interesting because this article, it's complimentary to the movie, but there's a lot of backhanded compliments as well because they do call it Z-list, right? But then they say, and I quote, that this is a passion project built on a foundation of uncommon artistic commitment. And they also laud the film for the sincerity and the heart and, once again, just the passion behind it. So, basically the story is this. We have an auteur by the name of Andrew Getty. Andrew Getty wrote and directed this film, and he's a scion of the Getty family, which is a...
Yeah, oil mavens. Their name precedes them, their reputation precedes them. In the 1920s, they were the richest family in America, a la the Carnegies and the Rockefellers. That's old money.
Mm-hmm.
And he came from that, and he funded this thing out of his own pocket over the span of a decade.
Old money
and a half.
Is opposed to you and I, which are no money.
No money, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
not
yeah,
new
exactly.
money, we're not sort of like middle of the road.
Oh my God, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the genesis of it was these nightmares that were plaguing him, mm-hmm. and it was his vision to try and articulate just how terrifying they were. And maybe he was just trying to exercise his demons through this production
right.
process, but he was trying to capture the dreamscapes that haunted him.
Yeah, because he wrote the script in 2002, and they were based on a series of nightmares he had. He wanted to take the nightmares from his head and visualize it up on the screen, maybe as a way of catharsis, maybe mm-hmm. a way of exercising these demons, as you mentioned earlier. So he wrote this script, and he was determined to spend as much of his fortune to bring this to fruition.
Yeah, and that's where he parts company with Ed Wood, because this guy was able to get actual talent and had the means and was able to put, $5 to $6 million into this film.
Well, the budget has been reputed to be within 4 to 6 million. I sort of want to take on Bertie if you saying actual talents. I think everybody in Edward movies have actual talents.
Okay, yeah.
But
that's okay.
No, but he has
named talents. Yeah.
Yeah, he assembled the cast, most notably John Rykon, Michael Berryman, of course, from The Hills Have Eyes, and so many other things. He needs no introduction. Just a fantastic human being. He also...
And that's not just conjecture, because you had the opportunity to talk to him for like 45 minutes, and you said, yeah, he's a wonderful guy. Listeners can check out the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Really down-to-earth, interesting character.
Well, one thing about Michael Berryman is he's just all heart. He's just an unbelievably genuine, caring, sweet individual, and I don't mean this in any way pejorative, but what's inside completely belies his appearance. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about Michael Berryman's appearance, but what I'm saying is that too many people might look at Michael Berryman and go like, oh my god, like, look, well, this guy looks bizarre, but the reality is looks are what they are, but what's on the inside of Michael Berryman is absolutely gorgeous. He's just a phenomenal human being. So we have Michael Berryman. Other cast members he got were Sean Patrick Flannery, who is probably best known for appearing alongside Norman Reedus, who went on to play Daryl Dixon in The Walking Dead and become the heartthrob to millions in The Boondock Saints. He also played young Indiana Jones on TV. He also got Dinah Meyer to appear in this, fresh off Starship Troopers. She was also in Marvelous 920, I believe.
Yeah, she did. As a love interest of Brendan Walsh, a.k.a. Jason Priestley on the show.
Mm-hmm. And he got a young actor by the name of, I believe it's Frederick Kohler, to play the main character. And so he gets his cast together, and unfortunately they didn't really know what they were getting into, because instead of a 3 to 6 month shooting schedule, this thing was done in fits and starts over a period of 5 years.
Yeah, their agents would not agree to that.
as Getty, he would painstakingly devise original custom camera rigs and build expensive sets and build animatronics, one no very notable one being an octopus that we see playing drums. And after the 5 years of principal photography, that wasn't enough, because then Getty took it for post and he sat on it, obsessing over every frame, perfecting each and every frame so that what was seen on screen would match what Getty saw in his own mind's eye. He spent most of his time and most of his personal fortune trying to get this film to be what he wanted to be. Unfortunately, he died 2 years ago in 2015 due to complications from a lifetime of meth abuse, and he never got to finish his film nor see it to completion, but some producers picked it up and ended up putting it together and releasing it. Now, you hear of a production like this that was so troubling, you would think that the film... resulting film would be an absolute mess. And in many ways, it doesn't totally come together cohesively, but there's some things in this movie that are just amazing. And I'm talking about some camera shots that are just unbelievably stunning, virtuosic, and real, genuine, earned frights. And another thing that's really unique about this film is that all the special effects, some of them very, very startling, very stunning, were accomplished in camera. And in this day and age, that's something to laud.
Well, yeah, he also had the luxury of been working within the theme or the motif of dreams and nightmares. So it could be a strength in many ways that you have a production that's haphazard, and when certain things don't make sense, you can ascribe it to the weirdness and the incomprehensibility that is your subconscious. So I didn't find it as jarring as maybe some people might have. There was some really interesting moments that we'll get into where things clearly have been, you don't want to say cobbled, it sounds kind of mean, but yeah, where they had footage and then they probably could have had a little more exposition and things were just sort of slammed together that didn't really fit, but it didn't matter because it all fits this kind of a Lynchian, sensibilities this film has.
Yeah,
and right off the bat.
Surrealism worthy of Buñuel or Dali as well. I mean, right off the bat, as this film begins, we're in a dream. And the protagonist of the movie is narrating the dream. And as we're hearing him narrating, and he's speaking in this very erudite, articulate, almost purple prose, and describing what's happening, and we see these surreal images, which ultimately lead him to sort of like a desert
kind of landscape. That was amazing. Yeah, it was like this foreground, background, like gestalt kind of carnival, like right in the middle of nowhere. Because anyone, a carnival is a common trope of the funhouse mirror. It's creepy inherently, but this was, it reminded me of the Nightmare on Elm Street 3 or some of the real more fleshed out visions of a nightmare. Like it was, the house was in the middle of nowhere, so It gave an otherworldly quality to it, and they're walking slowly. They approach the carnival.
He's
barker
with his mother,
with his
right?
mother, yeah.
Yep. And it's interesting because Freud and Jung, they posited that dreams are our way, the human psyche's way, of re-experiencing past trauma. So it's never articulated whether he actually went to some sort of carnival with his mother when he was young, because he's a child at the beginning of the movie, or not. But either way, off in the distance is one of those carnival fun houses where, you know, you pay your dollar, you go in some stupid rickety
car.
Step
right up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the carnival barker is actually Michael Behrman wearing a cheesy blonde wig and a mustache. Kind of almost like a, I don't know, he almost looks like, who's the Allman Brother just passed away?
Rest in peace, Greg Allman, the singer of the Allman Brothers at 69, yeah.
Yeah, so this ride is supposed to be the scariest ride ever, and with great anticipation, young Dennis gets in.
Gets into the cart, and they go around.
Well, they go in and out, and it's nothing.
Yeah.
And he turns to his mother, and he says, "What was that?" And the barker, the carnival barker, says something along the lines of, "Who says the ride's over?" In other words, this ride is never going to end. And as he's walking away, still holding the hand of his mother, he then looks at her, and what a startling image you get, because...
Yeah, her eyelids flip up and turn into upturned, gaping mouths. And that was right off the bat, just so unexpected. I thought they'd gotten out of there unscathed, and then he turns to her and like, whoa! I jumped out of my seat. Yeah. It was really amazing.
She's got these two eyelids, as well as her mouth, and they're all the same. They're just these like sort of gaping, fanged orifices. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And if that's not enough, he then finds himself in another dream where he's in front of a mirror, and we see our protagonist, and he then says something along the lines of, "You have to excuse myself, I'm not as erudite in real life as I am in my dreams." And our protagonist is it's Dennis Peterson, and he's a mentally challenged individual around 30 years old, and he's standing in a room. He doesn't know how he got there, and he's standing in front of an antique mirror. And as he looks into the mirror, instead of seeing his own reflection, he sees a character who was listed in the credits as a cadaver, but you said he was also...
The storyteller, I think, as well, yeah. And that's...
Was that also an alternate title for this film, or...?
Mm. I believe it was, yeah.
And it's Michael Berryman, and he's looking demonic, he's got this real gray pallor, and he leaps out of the mirror onto poor Dennis. And this is just another scene that just blows your mind. You've never seen anything like this before in imagination or ingenuity.
Well, I said it earlier. I don't know if you agree with this. I thought it was a rape scene when I saw him, because he grabbed him from behind and was on top of him. And I thought, like, well, I read about Stephen King talking about the zipless fuck, which is something Erica Jong mentioned during the 70s revolution and the coming of age people sexually. This is like a zippered fuck, where he
attaches
a zipper to Dennis from behind, from his neck, and opens him and slides his arms into Dennis and zips up the suit, and their bodies fuse. And that was just, I was that will sit with me, I can honestly say, till my deathbed.
And it's interesting because, yes, they fuse, and as this movie continues, in the real world, not the dream world, he's haunted by the cadaver.
Yeah.
And in many ways, the cadaver is a doppelganger for Dennis. Because sometimes when he looks in the mirror and he sees the cadaver, he sees him as Michael Behrman. Other times he sees him as himself. And he sort of becomes a cadaver and vice versa. He has to do acts that are...
in order to assuage his terrible nightmares that he has to... He has to
endure.
In exchange, it's blackmail. He has to perform these kind of acts. And at first, what is it? The neighborhood. This is again
another act
of neighborhood
violence,
kitty.
Yeah.
The neighborhood kitty. It's a tabby, I believe. And he goes, and they do a cutaway where he actually goes, kills the neighborhood cat, stuffs it in a freezer, and then
perform. And then it escalates, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, so we go from animals to human beings, and so on. And we don't want to get too deep into the plot.
Yeah, it's the themes that sort of override the plot. Yeah, because all it boils down to is the medium through which Dennis is communicating is the mirror, and from the great beyond, which is the storyteller cadaver, gets him to do these things. And but that's pitted against the natural sympathies you would have with someone who is mentally challenged, and that's, I think, part of the genius in this film, which is people have derided it and saying it's exploitative, but I like the fact that you're challenged to sympathize or empathize with the main character. You said you do with, in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the slow-witted antagonist there, because he's almost lovable in a way. These are your words.
He is,
in a way. And this,
but on the other hand, I despise Francis.
Well, that's another kind of genius there.
Yeah, because here we have one of the most annoying characters in the history of celluloid, and he's in a wheelchair, he's handicapped, he's, I guess, is it paraplegic? I think he's paraplegic.
Yeah.
I don't believe he's quadriplegic. And you just hate him from the get-go, and that really, you know, there's this real sort of push-pull where it's like, well, do I have to sympathize with this person?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's kind of genius in a way.
And in this movie, I mean, we do, okay, let's just pull back a bit, because, yes, he does commit these heinous crimes. However, he does so because he needs respite. He needs freedom from this prison he's in, which are these never-ending nightmares, some of which are absolutely horrific. There's another one involving a giant spider, which just came out of nowhere and blew my mind. And in order to escape these nightmares, it's not like Nightmare on Elm Street, where there's somebody in your dreams that is threatening you and is trying to kill you, and if you get killed in your dreams, you die in real life. No. He's not being threatened physically. He's being threatened mentally and psychologically. He wants these nightmares to end. He just wants to have a peaceful rest. Nightmares are, they can be some of the most traumatic things in the world. I've been plagued by nightmares. I'm sure you have as well.
Oh, yeah. Generally being chased by animals or just, yeah. And it's something that takes weeks to get over and overcome. And if you can return to the same ones, which is so unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. I've had nightmares where I wake up so unnerved. And it takes me a moment or two to actually kind of re-grasp the foundation of my reality. Like, that was just a dream. And you almost have to question yourself.
That was just a dream. Oh, I'm singing some R.E.M. there. Okay. But okay, no, go on. Sorry.
How dare you sell your podcast with late period Michael Scott.
Yeah, exactly. but also there's a certain kind of genius to the tension between the two brothers, because there's two people with whom you can easily sympathize. Yeah. And he's the caretaker, the custodian. Yeah. You're going, I could be him. Mm-hmm. If I had a sibling, I would have to look after him. Would I be able to do all these unpleasant tasks that are involved, you know, with someone who can't fend for themselves? Could I do this? Maybe.
He's
being pressured, again, by his girlfriend to maybe put young Dennis in a home.
Right, because I just want to say, he's under the guardianship of his older brother.
It's like a Rain Man kind of thing.
Yeah, and his John, who has his girlfriend Lydia. John is devoted to his brother for two reasons. Number one, because he's his guardian, but number two, he feels a little complicit, a little guilty as to why Dennis is the way he is, and he has his girlfriend Lydia, who really wants...
Dennis is a stumbling block to furthering their relationship.
Right.
She doesn't
really
want
Dennis,
a third party. Like, it's, you know...
She wants Dennis out of the picture so she can marry John and they can live happily ever after, sell the house, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But getting back to nightmares, there's a line in this movie where Dennis says, a dream is a story I tell myself. But then he goes on to say something along the lines of, I trick myself, because I tell myself the story, but I don't know how it's going to end. And then he says, and this is quite profound, how can I trick myself? For example, I can't tell a joke and not know the punchline, but that's sort of what a nightmare is. I mean, we tell ourselves these stories subconsciously as we're sleeping.
It's just a premise. It has no punchline. You don't know the meaning.
But isn't it amazing how, you know, you and I, and I would say
100%
of our
listeners
are, you know, we love horror movies. We love watching nightmares on celluloid. And yet, our subconscious has this ability every night to create a horror movie. and some of them are, I mean, I would say if I was
most of them are worse than anything we've subjected ourselves to.
There's that,
with rare exceptions, yeah.
If I was to actually keep a dream journal and write down my dreams, I'm not one of these people to do so, analyze dreams, what have you, I would say I have more unpleasant dreams than I do have pleasant dreams. I have more nightmares than I have dreams where I'm like, oh, I didn't want to wake up, that was really good.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's amazing that we have this ability to create horror movies in our mind each and every night, and most of us find them to be quite unpleasant, but at the same time, we then seek out these nightmares on celluloid.
It's quite a paradox. I've never thought about that. Mm-hmm. And you would think that because of all the anxiety you endure in your waking life, that the last thing you would have in your dream life is something that would further compound that. You'd think it would wipe the slate clean, and through evolution, you would have some means of purging all these negative thoughts you have maybe from the day, but it's quite the opposite. It's like a feedback loop, like the anxiety you have in the day gets fed into what you have at night, and it comes back, and then you can't sleep, and it just furthers it.
And as I said before, with both, I mean, Freud and Jung, I mean, they didn't agree on a lot, but they both agreed that nightmares are just us re-experiencing past trauma. And some of this is so buried deep within our subconscious about things that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, coming back to haunt us again and again and again, this feedback loop, and it's, when you really, like, analyze the nightmare, it's...
I have frequent nightmares of my father, who's in a long-term care facility for people with Alzheimer's, and it's just having him just stand there, and it's just so just heartbreaking. It makes my heart pound. I wake up, and then I start to think, like I start to fill in the details of this. It's like, wait, maybe I could have done more. Maybe I should visit more. Like, I don't know what more to do. It's just these things. So forget about people just wanting to cause you physical harm. It's the psychological harm that it's manifesting itself here.
And it's interesting, too, because this film inspired me to research the etymology of the word nightmare. Why is it called a nightmare? I mean, obviously it takes place at night. Mare, I think of a horse,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in actuality, it's Old English, and a mare was a mythological demon who torments others while they sleep by placing these horrific stories within their minds.
Well,
and there are so many mythological, folklore, legendary figures within different cultures of sleep demons. So,
yeah, the succubus and the incubus. But even in this film, there's allusions to spiders as well. When you talk about folklore within West African folklore, a spider is a trickster. Here, for probably
Anansi.
Obvious, Anansi, the House of Anansi is a publisher we got rejected by. But anyway,
there's Anansi Boys by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, and luring its prey into a trap, and then so it's an interesting conceit because during the film, Dennis is watching a documentary about how spiders, much like praying mantis, who there's sexual dimorphism. Ooh, that's fancy. Where the female is actually much larger than the male, so it's something we can't really relate to because we're stronger. But yeah, they own the males, and he's fascinated by this. It gets involved in this lengthy discussion of morality and ethics and whatnot.
And this also contributes to his perception of Dinah Meyer's character, Lydia, and how she's taking his brother away from him. She's basically dominant, and he's afraid. He's afraid that
of losing a sibling. It's a theme we explored in Pin just recently.
Mm-hmm. So another theme that this film has going for it that I want to explore is the mirror. Because when he first encounters the cadaver, or the storyteller, it's this antique mirror that...
His brother foists on him that he doesn't want in his room.
Right.
Yeah.
But it then doesn't... It's no longer limited just to the antique mirror. Any mirror. He's at a Chuck E. Cheese type restaurant. He looks in a mirror and he sees a reflection telling him to do something nefarious, whether it's his own reflection or the cadaver. They're both the same. And the mirror is a very interesting symbol. I mean, it's kind of a trope that's been used in a lot of different tales. I mean, I'm thinking like, you know, Snow White, Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Who's the Fairest in the Mall?
Mm-hmm.
So many horror movies that have used the mirror.
Oculus, Boogeyman, Uli Lomo's film. Yeah, Cursed Mirror is kind of a cliche. Another cliche is looking in a mirror and the antagonist arrives behind you and frightens you. But here it's used differently. Used for personal, quiet, solitude monologue moments between him and, well, his alter ego, if you will, or him and Michael Behrman's demon. But yeah, from a semiotics standpoint, like, mirrors have a certain, I mean, a quality to them, because before their existence, people would have to rely on other people for the, almost their own identity. And now you've almost gone 180 degrees away from that, where people are too enraptured by their own identity. And I was just speaking as someone who logged into their Instagram account, and that site is peppered with people's just an overarching abuse of selfies and feet and meals, and everything is so solipsistic and ridiculous. It's like, I don't care what you ate, but it all started with the mirror. It's the original selfie, and before mirrors you had to like rely on the water for your reflection. How else would you know?
Like,
how would
you know what you look like? If you were some sort of duke or king, you could commission someone to paint a
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's interesting you mentioned the portraiture, because the only time you would paint anything that wasn't religious in nature was a portrait, because that was the only thing that flew, as it were. You couldn't really paint anything else. It was just a portrait, because you didn't have a mirror, or religious iconography, and that's it. So it's interesting how it's used here.
But it's interesting, because earlier you were saying, when we were discussing this, you were saying about how the mirror can be empowering, because people can look at themselves and go, oh yeah, I'm the shit. But a lot of that has to do with your self-image, your self-esteem, how comfortable you are within your own skin, and so on and so forth. Because some people, they look in the mirror and they get a boost, whereas other people, the mirror can be their greatest enemy.
Be disempowering, yeah.
Disempowering, because if you're not enamored with your own
physicality, yeah, your body,
you know,
issues,
level of body issues, you look in the mirror is your absolute enemy. And the other thing about the mirror, and photography as well, they say we really don't know how we truly look, how other people perceive us, because the mirror is not a true reflection of our appearance, because
so
it's
to speak, yeah, exactly, yeah, you're right.
Same with photography as well. So none of us know how we look in other people's eyes. So
that's probably for the best.
To get this message from the mirror, but the mirror deceives, the mirror lies. And in this movie, the mirror doesn't deceive, the mirror doesn't lie. What the mirror does is it corrupts.
Oh yeah, well, like the funhouse mirror from the carnival, where you look in it and then you got your, you know, your belly is all distended, or you have your 10 feet tall, or yeah, it all comes back to the carnival. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the mirror becomes just a focal point of everything that, through the means through which Dennis receives these messages, and then the film just ratchets up the tension as he gets instructed with more commands as to what to do further and escalate. But there's more to it than that, because there's the dynamic of John and Lydia and wanting to get rid of him in a sense, and John seeking out, I guess, psychological treatment. He seeks counsel of a therapist to try and deal with these issues he has of abandonment, where he feels guilty about getting rid of his brother and trying to further his relationship with Lydia. This would be John, yeah. And he has an incredible scene with this therapist. And there's a dreamscape motif runs throughout this whole movie, but there's a scene where he thinks he sees his therapist at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether this was a dream in of itself, that like he started having dreams. It has a very Lynchian quality. He taps the fellow on the shoulder, says, "Hey, doctor," I forget his name.
Right.
And because he's been giving him extra sessions over lunchtime, because the regular hour...
Dr. Preston,
yeah, the couch sessions aren't cutting it. This guy's so messed up in his head. And he sees him, and he turns around, and it's another, you don't want to use the term freakish figure, but someone with a physical deformity who the psychiatrist morphs into, a giant 7-foot-tall guy with a strange visage.
Well, this would be the late Matthew McGorry, who was a member of the Howard Stern Whack Pack.
Ooh.
Bigfoot, but he was also in, he suffered from, I believe it was gigantism,
yeah.
And he passed away very young, but he was also in House of a Thousand Corpses. He played with the original Dr. Satan. He had a role in Big Fish, where he wasn't under prosthetics, but Matthew McGorry, and that's another indication that this film was filmed a long time ago, because I'm not quite sure what year Matthew passed away. But it was quite a while ago. And it's interesting you bring that up, too, because that whole part was sort of disjointed, where John and Lydia are driving around, was it Los Angeles where they were?
Yes, yeah, I believe so.
And they don't recognize anybody, nobody recognizes them, and they're like, what the heck is going on here?
Well, yeah, I mean, Susan, the ice cream clerk, has been murdered. She's replaced by someone who kind of looks vaguely similar to her. Their regular maitre d' has been replaced. Their regular waitress has been replaced at their favorite steak joint. Everything seems somewhat off-kilter.
But this is very Carnival of Souls, because in Carnival of Souls, there's these scenes where the heroine, the protagonist, I forget the name of the, shame on me for forgetting it, but played by Candice Hildegloss, where all of a sudden she goes off in these, I don't know, like fugue states, but they're not really a fugue state, because she's well aware of what's going on, but nobody recognizes her, and she's walking around, let's say, a department store, and she's asking for help, and other people are talking and doing stuff, but they don't notice her, and she's, it's extremely chilling, extremely nightmarish, and, because can you imagine, like, being out in public, and you're just sort of
like... Well, it's the ultimate form of loneliness, I guess, yeah, it's just, you're not being responded to in a way that you're accustomed to in society, and I've had dreams like that as well, where you're just, you're almost shouting, and and someone is ignoring you, it's unpleasant.
So, the ultimate theme of this movie is a dream, and this is not Nightmare on Elm Street again, this is not a boogeyman who kills you in your dreams. This is not a slasher. It's not a slasher film. It's more of a psychological film with supernatural elements. But the connecting thread of this movie is the surrealism of the dream and the nightmare. And Getty,
recreates these with such verve and panache.
He succeeds so well because there's just sequences that are very surreal and very, and you know, they're nightmares, and you're just like, wow, that really replicates what it's like to have a nightmare. But then even the scenes of normalcy feel disjointed, nightmarish. So every debit may actually be work in this film's favor and be a credit. Ultimately, I think The Evil Within is a very, almost like a piece of outsider art. I mean, Getty was certainly an outsider in the Hollywood system, but I think it's a bit of a masterpiece. I really like it, and I don't, before we go into our What Have We Learned, I'm going to just give you my star rating for this film. I'm giving it 4 stars.
Likewise. I was consistently captivated by every frame, and again, like the debits, I tried to pull one earlier. It's just, sure, things are disjointed, but within the confines of what you're working with, it doesn't matter that it's disjointed, because that's what dreams are. You go from one room to another. Things don't make temporal sense. Things don't make logical sense. Things are disjointed. If they had had a different plot, this might have been much more obvious. But yeah, I would give it 3 3/4, if not round it up to 4. Almost a must see. So what did we learn?
Well, I guess this goes back to the tortured artist, in the sense that so many creative people, so many people that have singular visions, obsessions, whatnot, that they want to get out within their medium of choice, whether it be music, painting, filmmaking, writing, etc. They're tortured individuals, and they're plagued by obsessions and certain things that just make their lives. I mean, I'm thinking just about Chris Cornell, who recently took his own life, and that just shook me to the core. And, you know, I mean, Getty is, he's not somebody who's going to be going down in history as one of the greats. I mean, unfortunately, he's going to be relegated to the fringe, just to a footnote. This film is, it was just released, but it pretty much already is a footnote. But I don't know. I mean, there's just something about the link between creativity and madness. And
well, yeah, if they are linked, or whether it's just the ones that have been mad or the ones that have been the most prominent. Yeah, your Van Goghs or the people who've not met with success during their lifetime and have to do so posthumously, it just fills me with a lot of sadness. And I hope that doesn't actually, to be perfectly frank, happen to us. We would like some success within our lifetime, and we're going to continue writing books and whatnot.
And it's interesting, too, because when I was watching this movie, I was thinking about John Kennedy Toole.
Yes.
Confederacy of Dunces. Somebody else who never lived
Pulitzer
to see...
Prize-winning author. Yeah, and his mother put together the scraps of the manuscript, sent it to a publisher. By that time, he had already since committed suicide, sadly, and this book is a work of genius.
It's my favorite books of all
time. Two copies. And, yeah.
And, again, I mean, this this is not going to be as lauded as the Confederacy of Dunces. I mean, that won a posthumous Pulitzer Prize. But I hope that as time goes on, more and more people discover The Evil Within. The title's really not doing the movie much
in any way
of favors. It's a very generic title.
It's very broad, yeah.
But I really hope that people discover this film, overlook some of the flaws, and really appreciate it for what it is. A singular work of obsession from somebody who had a lot of demons, somebody who was quite tortured, but basically gave his life to creating some art that, when you dig into it, is quite resonant rich with themes and subtext and so on. So, yeah.
Only time will tell. We'll see. So what did I learn here? Well, it's always great to see animatronic band. I mean, thinking of the Abominable Dr. Fibes, there's something just sort of kind of creepy about seeing smooth, fluid, natural behavior being recreated by machines. That's something unsettling. Like, if you go to some historical crappy thing and you have, like, I don't know, if Americans, maybe like Abe Lincoln will come out.
The Hall of Presidents at Disneyland.
Like Abe Lincoln will come out in 420 years ago and his mouth will go up and down and it's just something phony and ridiculous and creepy about it. And so disingenuous and so odd. And the motions are off, so you have. And quite an interesting scene where they're in this restaurant, which is just awful and nightmarish in of its own right. It's a seafood restaurant that's one of Dennis's favorites, and it's got, again, as you mentioned, the octopus, the octopus drumming.
Well, it's Chuck E. Cheese.
It's Chuck E. Cheese, but in it,
band.
There's something just so awful about that, regardless of the band. Like, there's something so phony. Again, like, it has this. Yeah, the theme is ridiculous. It's almost like a. I don't know, like a Hooters type thing where you're going in and the whole thing reeks of artifice, the whole thing is phony beyond belief, and then you see this band start to play, and older brother Dennis starts explaining to him the workings of how the tubes and the electronics manifest themselves in making the motions of the animatronics, and Dennis says, I don't understand what you were talking about, but there's a great scene where the whole thing was just, that was nightmarish, even though it took place in the real world. That scene was almost maybe the third most frightening for me. I just thought this was very odd in the way that it, also the waiters were going through their emotions too. You're going through this thing that's phony business. Jeez, what else did I learn? Yeah, continuity errors be damned. I mean, you know, we've podcasted other films that have been labors of love that have taken years to complete. I didn't notice any major glaring temporal chronological issues in this film. Maybe I wasn't being observant enough, but over 15 years, my God, it seems to my mind fairly seamless. Maybe not even requiring a zipper in that scene, but yeah, I thought it worked. It worked well. I can't believe I'm giving this 4 stars because, again, it's crickets. It's tumbleweeds on IMDb. Like, no one is talking about this except for us, so we're championing this.
Well,
good on the late Andrew Getty.
Yeah.
Like,
and don't forget, when we talked with Scott in our last discussion with Scott Drebin.
Scott Drebin from Daily Dead, he liked it a lot, with reservations, I think, if I can speak for him. Yeah.
Well, this is a film I'm going to be revisiting again and again and again, and I do feel like as the years go on, it's interesting in the horror space where a lot of films really take about almost a generation to be rediscovered and reassessed and reappreciated. And I could list so many films that were derided upon release that now are considered to be great films. I'm not going to go through that list. There's many. I think this is going to be one of them.
Oh, I agree. And for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. which we hope will be recognized for its brilliance in our own lifetime. And also, I'm kidding, of course, awful_movies on Twitter. Follow us, tweet us your favorite underseen, underappreciated gems. And every Friday, check out new episodes. Be sure to subscribe to the Really Awful Movies podcast, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.